prison riot in South Carolina leaves 7 inmates dead.
The folks that are incarcerated are going to continue their criminal ways from behind bars, which is not only dangerous inside our institutions, but it's also dangerous outside our institutions.
But the prison was understaffed, and guards didn't move to stop the fighting for 4 hours. Also, a war photographer who uses her pictures to push back against stereotypes.
One of the limitations or the failings of photojournalism is that we so often are pushed to represent people at their most vulnerable.
And the recall of 200 million eggs is alarming, but may point to the strengths of America's food safety protections.
The system's working. You know, it's not perfect. We're always going to have some outbreaks, but they're smaller and we're catching them quicker.
Happy Tax Day, America. The President of the United States still hasn't released his tax returns. This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, April 17th, 2018. Getting bloody back here, that inmate says. That's from a video allegedly sent from inside the Lee Correctional Institution in Lee County, South Carolina on Sunday night. Bloody because 7 inmates were killed and 17 others injured after riots raged in the maximum security prison for nearly 8 hours. Brian Sterling is the director of the South Carolina Department of Corrections. He spoke yesterday.
What we believe from the initial investigation is that this was all about territory. This is about contraband. This is about cell phones, and you've heard us talk about these over and over again. These folks are fighting over real money and real territory while they're incarcerated.
Guards didn't move to stop the riots for more than 4 hours, and it took almost 8 hours for the fights to end, leaving a scene of horror at Lee Correctional. The prison houses about 1,600 male inmates incarcerated for the most serious crimes, and on Sunday night, the state says there were only 44 guards on duty.
Hey, Jack, how are you doing, bro?
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Todd Zwillick. And that's where we begin today with Valerie Borlein, national reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who formerly reported in South Carolina. Valerie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
These fights broke out on Sunday night. Do we know the cause of the violence at Lee?
Well, the corrections director said in a press conference on Monday that gang violence runs rampant at Lee Correctional, which is the largest maximum security prison in South Carolina, and it houses some of the most violent felons in the state. And gang violence is attributable, and then just also really a rampant use of cell phones to coordinate activity across the prison, even though people are housed in different dorms.
Well, what do reports say the scene was like as these riots went on?
Extremely grim. The scene was extremely grim by what witnesses are saying and by these videos that have been posted online. And the prisons department did confirm yesterday that there were bodies that were stacked up against some internal barriers and just a really tough scene for all involved.
Well, Valerie, Lee Correctional has a history of violence. Parts of the prison have been taken over by inmates in the past. Just 3 weeks ago, a guard was briefly held hostage. Can you give us a sense of the history of violence and even insurrection at Lee Correctional?
Nikki Haley, when she was governor, famously toured Lee Correctional to draw attention to the state of affairs there and said, this is the most violent prison in the state. It was built in the early 90s, like a lot of prisons in the rural South, as a way to bring jobs and sort of an economic boom to these rural areas. But it has been, for the last decade, really understaffed and become an increasingly violent place. And there's a funny relationship. There's a funny thing going on with sentencing. The changes in sentencing guidelines in the U.S., we have fewer people in prison. You know, the lowest level in a decade are the levels of people in prison right now, but the people who are there are convicted of increasingly violent offenses. So what the corrections professionals will tell you is, look, we have fewer people in prison, but they're the ones who really need to be there and are quite violent in some cases. And then also this larger macroeconomic function of a really low unemployment. So 4% unemployment, it's hard to find employees for many jobs, particularly one as difficult as being a correctional officer in a rural town.
You mentioned staffing. The governor and the head of the prison authority, who we heard from just a moment ago, place the blame squarely on inmates. And certainly inmates who cause violence are responsible for it. But does that tell us the whole story? What about staffing? What about people on hand who could have either separated these fighting parties or prevented the riot in the first place?
Well, to your earlier point about the history of violence at Lee, there have been a number of violent incidents there, guards being held hostage or dorms that are taken over by inmates for lengths of time. And you're talking about a dorm of 250 people that's, typically on a good day, maybe staffed by six officers. And one of the things officers will tell you is, look, we're armed with pepper spray. We're not going in there with weapons that are intimidating, really, especially if we're badly outnumbered. And there has been sort of if you talk to corrections folks, they'll tell you that the incidences of violence in the past year to 2 years, in North Carolina, for example, there were four guards who were killed last year when inmates took over a work facility. Also last year, there was another guard who was beaten to death with a fire extinguisher when she went in to put out a fire that had been intentionally set in a cell. So I think there's a sense, or the professionals tell us that there's a sense of, make sure you're in a safe position that you can walk back out of before you walk into a dorm where riots or fights are taking place.
So that might explain, and it does make sense why guards may not have wanted to intervene if it just wasn't safe in this situation. But nearly 1,600 inmates at Lee Correctional and 44 guards on duty. I wonder if there's a serious conversation in South Carolina, not only about staffing levels, but also the quality and the training of corrections officers.
It's a good point, and it was raised several times with the director yesterday and with the governor, who said, look, we've worked to get staffing levels higher, and the corrections director has gone to the legislature every year for years and said, we're in an increasingly dangerous place. And it's not just South Carolina. The Florida corrections director, for example, last year told the legislature, if I don't get more money for more staff here, I cannot guarantee the safety of these prisons for the people who are housed there and also for the people who are working there. But if you think about state budgeting, what we know is just the cost of Medicaid and pensions and other public functions have gone up so much that corrections often gets funded last. It's not as popular to fund as education or other priorities. That's what the legislators will tell you. So the advocates will tell you, look, prisons have been starved for a long time in this country, and it's hard to catch up in just a short period of time.
Valerie Borlein, national reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, those deadly riots at Lee Correctional Institution in South Carolina were especially bad, but they're not altogether unique. Violence plagues overcrowded prisons nationwide, just as Valerie Borlein said. And we wanted to get a sense of some of the conditions that can go along with that violence in places outside of South Carolina. Amy Fettig joins me now. She's deputy director of the ACLU's National Prison Project. Amy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
What's your reaction to this particular incident in South Carolina in the context of prison violence that I know you follow across the country?
Well, of course, it is a terrible tragedy and actually an extreme event. We rarely see an incident of prison violence where seven people are killed. So there is a lot that the state of South Carolina needs to do to remedy this situation. But in terms of prison violence, both in South Carolina and across the country, there are some common things that we often see, and we're seeing here in South Carolina too. Violence in prison has so much to do with the way prisons are managed and operated and, frankly, overseen. More than the prisoners themselves, it is the operation and the culture of violence on both the part of the officers and the prisoners that often leads to these types of situations.
And it can get complicated talking about responsibility when it comes to violence like this inside a prison. Certainly the perpetrators are responsible, but there are antecedents and conditions all over the place that those of us on the outside have a hard time understanding. What conditions in prison generally go alongside these types of violent incidents?
Well, exactly what we're seeing in South Carolina. Poorly trained, inexperienced staff, understaffing, bad retention, poorly paid staff, and frankly, a lack of accountability on the part of the prison. Now, Lee Correctional Facility, we know that there's been an increasing pattern of violence in that facility for years. The writing was on the wall, but not enough was done. And when we look at that type of violence, repeated violence that increases and escalates to this terrible tragedy that we now see, what we know is that that culture of violence pervaded that institution on both sides, so that staff were afraid and prisoners were afraid, and that becomes a toxic mix to what we see now, which is a horrendous loss of life.
Talking about this in retrospect is difficult, Amy, but nearly 1,600 inmates and 44 guards on staff reportedly on Sunday night seems like a recipe for guards to just easily lose control of the situation.
Absolutely. There should never have been that level of understaffing. And we know in South Carolina and across the country that understaffing is a huge problem. Because frankly, these are pretty terrible jobs. I mean, our institutions are terrible places to be incarcerated in, and they are terrible places to work. Because there is understaffing, there's overcrowding, there are abusive environments. People don't actually want to work in these places any more than they want to live in them. But unfortunately, what we've done in the United States is create this massive prison and jail complex that we don't want to fund appropriately. And the result, unfortunately, are violent institutions that make nobody better off. People return to the community worse off. And they're places that nobody wants to work because they're dangerous.
Amy Fettig, we're going to talk about reform, of course. And there's so much prison reform and criminal justice reform being talked about in this country right now. Are there any places, any institutions or any municipality states that are doing this right or at least better?
Well, I think there are some that are doing it better than South Carolina, but the sad truth is that across the country, prisons and jails face budget shortfalls. They still face massive overcrowding and understaffing and conditions that are both violent but also degrading for the individuals who are housed there. So it's not surprising that we have a toxic mix in this country in prisons and jails. You know, there has been some sentencing reform, but not enough. We still have tons and tons of really nonviolent low-level offenders who could be better served in the community.
And so that makes me wonder if the national debate in Congress and elsewhere on prison reform is taking this issue seriously of overcrowded conditions and poor staffing in prisons.
We need a more serious approach. And one of the things that hasn't been talked about is the fact that these institutions have virtually no public oversight, and it has virtually no accountability to the public.
Accountability in prisons. Look, there's a national debate in Congress on sentencing, but these are state institutions in South Carolina and elsewhere, and it's going to be up to individual states to debate and reform this system, if indeed that's what's going to happen after this horrific riot where seven people were left dead in South Carolina. Amy Fettig with the ACLU's National Prison Project, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we've been asking you if you've ever had an experience with violence in prison, and a lot of you responded.
This is Brian in Santa Fe, New Mexico. When I was in Cleveland, I had a DUI. I did 10 days in the Lake County Jail in Painesville. Had it been any longer, I would be dead. I was completely suicidal from someone going through our cells every hour, all night, slamming the doors. That is why there is violence. And the guards just think it's funny.
Hello, my name is Daniel. While I was being held in the North Broward jail facility, as breakfast was being served, I was given a breakfast that was not mine. I had requested kosher food, but the guard that was overseeing the distribution of the food became very angry, and he attacked me, strangling me, pushing his thumbs into my eyes, and it was witnessed by everyone in the unit. I started screaming in panic to make sure that as many people as possible could hear me. And it was very clear that he wanted me to spit in his face so that he could charge me with felony battery on a law enforcement operator.
My name is Melody. I'm calling from Weymouth. And my cousin was arrested in New Jersey. He went in to sign the plea deal and was remanded to custody. He was there for about a month and was beaten brutally to the point that he was comatose. He had several surgeries, one to open up his skull to accommodate for the swelling of his brain.
LEO, that's felony battery on a law enforcement officer. Keep sharing your stories with us on the Takeaways Facebook page. We've been talking a lot on this show about the flood of opioids across America. Well, here's a story that's not about too many opioids, but not enough. There's a serious shortage of injectable opioids. These are the drugs used for pain management during surgeries or cancer treatment or serious injuries. Hospitals across the country are scrambling for alternatives during the shortage, and medical professionals are worried about the impact on patients. Aaron Schachter is executive editor and producer at our partner WGBH, and he's been following the story in Boston.
Well, if you can believe it, there are only three companies that really produce injectable opioids. We're talking hydromorphone, which most people know as Dilaudid, morphine, and fentanyl. There are three companies that make them. The biggest one is Pfizer, and Pfizer had to take their Kansas plant offline back in the summer, and the two other companies just can't make up the difference.
Now, what's been the effect on hospitals in terms of the opioids they can get in for routine medical procedures, surgeries, and patients?
Well, it's actually just crazy. You have hospitals all over the country kind of juggling those three medicines, Dilaudid, morphine, and fentanyl. Every week, they're looking at their supplies, and one of them, generally Dilaudid, that's the most popular drug or the most used drug in surgeries and pain medication, is out. And at Mass General Hospital here, I attended a meeting of the opioid shortage working group, and the pharmacist of the hospital was saying that they had a week's supply left of this drug, and that means they have to start juggling with these other two. The chief medical officer at Mass General is O'Neill Britton.
Now we're at the point where our worries and fears are proven to be true. And so we're asking for a revisit in what we're doing and saying we need a more fine-tuned approach. And so that continues to frighten us.
Part of the fear that hospitals around the country are facing is that generally medical personnel work with one particular drug because there's so much Dilaudid, for example. And when they have to switch to another drug like fentanyl, it takes time to figure out the exact doses and exactly how to use it. And as we've heard with the opioid crisis, fentanyl is 20 times more potent than something like Dilaudid or morphine. And so Britton at Mass General Hospital says there is a real concern that medical personnel could misuse drugs.
When you're asking people to switch to new medicines, even though they may work similar or even though they may have the same effect, quite frankly, it does take time for those same kind of almost memory dictionary to be developed. And that, you know, does present risk.
Aaron, these are potentially dangerous drugs in the hospital, and he's talking about the potential for serious medical errors.
Yeah, and when I was at that opioid shortage working group at Mass General Hospital, they actually talked about a case where a nurse practitioner in the middle of the night, about 2 a.m, was about to give a patient the same prescription of fentanyl as he or she would have for Dilaudid. And that amount of fentanyl would have killed the patient. And there were gasps in the room. There were about 30 people in the room, and they were really nervous. Luckily, in this case, somebody noticed that the prescription was wrong, and they were able to catch it in time. But everybody in that meeting realizes they dodged a bullet then, and it could be really dangerous at some point.
So, Aaron, what about the supply side here? Pfizer had to go offline for a few months. There are a couple of other companies that make injectable opioids. Can't they make up the difference?
Well, Pfizer controls at least 60% of the market of injectable opioids around the country. In some markets, I'm told they control about 80%. So these other two companies just can't make up the difference. They're trying. I spoke with a company called Westward. Dan Motto is the guy at Westward who runs their injectable opioid business, and he says they're trying.
We've been shifting our production schedule. We've been adding shifts for our employees. We're paying overtime. We're not sitting here with an empty plant.
Westward would love to be able to sell more opioids, I'm sure, to make up the difference. But you can't just conjure this stuff, and it's highly regulated.
Yeah, and that's another part of the problem, at least from the hospital's and manufacturer's perspective. The DEA regulates how much of the raw materials for opioids each company, each factory gets. And these companies are saying the DEA has a tough job with the opioid crisis going on. They recognize that. but they are saying they need more raw materials so they can make up the difference from the shortage caused by Pfizer. The DEA counters said, you know, wait a minute. We give you what we know you need. It is your choice, they say, to decide whether to make opioids in pills or whether to make injectable opioids. And this is Rusty Payne. He's the spokesman from the DEA.
This is where people get confused. We do not issue quota on products. We issue quota on the raw ingredients. It's the company's decisions as to what products they're going to make out of the allotment of raw materials that they've been given to produce.
Aaron, what's Rusty Payne of the DEA getting at there? Is he suggesting that these companies are using the raw materials they have for opioid products that make more money?
Yeah, that is what he's suggesting. The reality is that pills make a lot more money. There are a set number of hospitals who generally order a set amount of injectable opioids every year. Their number of surgeries doesn't change a whole lot. And the profit margin on injectable opioids is just minuscule in comparison to pills. So Rusty Payne is saying, look, if there's a problem out there, it's up to you guys to fix it. That said, they have increased the quota for the two other companies that do make injectable opioids. Westward is one, and they are ramping up production.
And we've seen time after time as the opioid crisis has developed, and not in hospitals and not with injectables, but incidents and accusations of drug companies flooding the market with opioid pills, putting out way more than patients or doctors could conceivably need for clinical use.
Yeah, it's a terrible irony, which the pharmacists and hospitals are very clear about. And just so people understand, these are the drugs, injectable opioids are the drugs that you get for surgery, you know, in your IV for cancer care before and after surgery. So what hospitals are trying to do is use less. They're saying conservation is key. They're going to use less of the liquid form of the drug. They're using Tylenol and ibuprofen when they can, and getting people actually onto the pill form of opioids as quickly as possible. And this thing could go on through a year from now, through summer 2019. So you can imagine people are quite nervous.
Aaron Schachter, executive editor and producer at WGBH in Boston. Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page, tweet us at The Takeaway, or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
It's good to have you with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. War photography has a long tradition in journalism. It's designed to bring readers close to conflict, to make us confront the awful realities of combat so that we can hold leaders accountable. And to that end, war photos often tend toward grim, desperate images of the destruction and the personal toll of grief and loss. Photographs depicting victims. Well, journalist Anastasia Taylor-Lind traveled to the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar to photograph Rohingya refugees for Human Rights Watch, and she saw those kinds of images in real life, suffering unlike anything she'd seen in her 15-year career, she says. But instead of taking war photos as we've come to know them, Taylor-Lind took a new approach to photographing the victims.
One of the limitations or the failings of photojournalism is that we so often are pushed to represent people at their most vulnerable and their most distressed. And of course, as you imagine, more than 500,000 people with nothing, living in very desperate conditions, desperate for shelter, food, for the basic necessities of life. The problem with photographing people in that way is that we start to understand that they're somehow different from us. And it was with this in mind, with those tropes of photojournalism in mind, that I decided instead of approaching this in a reportage way, I would set up a makeshift portrait studio. And I would try to photograph the people I met in the same way that I would photograph my mother or my friends or somebody who asked me to make a portrait of them in London.
So what rises to the surface for you as the photographer, just placing a subject, in this case, a victim of a massacre or an expulsion or a torture, just in relief against a dark background.
In terms of telling these stories, we're dealing with a matter of scale. So many Rohingya have been forcibly pushed out of their homes, their villages, burnt to the ground behind them, and now living in these sprawling refugee camps inside of Bangladesh. So we're talking about very large numbers. But again, the essence of portrait photography is that you don't represent people as statistics. You're able to take one person and one face and one story and to look at them. And the experience as well of being a photographer, of sitting with someone in silence, having removed the clutter of the refugee camp and the swarms of people around us, and just being able to be with one person and to be with them. That's not to say that traditional photojournalists represents this situation in a way that's untrue. Of course, those things are true. People were fighting for food and building makeshift shelters, and the aid distribution was sometimes happening, and whole families were wading through flooded paddy fields to reach the refugee camps. But it's also true that when people arrived, maybe these portraits are a proof of life.
Being seen is a proof of survival, in a sense.
It struck me so much how willing everybody was to be photographed, how they allowed me to make their picture. And I wonder if, in some senses, that is connected with this idea that they survived when often their entire families did not.
Well, I find us returning to the place of empathy here, Anastasia. It's a theme that comes up so often when I talk to journalists or other people who've borne witness in the way that you have. It's very difficult, if not impossible, for listeners of a public radio show or readers of a magazine to gain empathy for victims when they see pictures of war, hear stories of war on the radio. But I think you've gotten much, much closer to a place of empathy one-on-one with your photographs.
I wonder if the solution in part lies in representing others in the way that we would expect to represent ourselves. I am defined now by my gender, my occupation, my relationships to my family members. I would be introduced as a photographer, somebody from England, Daniel's sister. But when something like this happens in your community or your country, suddenly all of those identities are stripped away by us, journalists. The people that we tell stories about become statistics, collateral damage, refugees, massacre survivors. They provide eyewitness testimonies, sound bites. There's something very dehumanizing in this process. And in terms of the visual representation of conflict, we usually photograph people at war in a very different way than we would our own communities at peace. So perhaps some of the solution lies in fighting this, the system of photojournalism and journalism, but also our own compulsion to represent people as the other.
You've used this method in other conflicts as well. I read that you went to Ukraine on assignment, and I've seen your photographs of Ukrainians, young and old, men and women, soldiers, protesters, in front of a black screen there as well.
I should say that my background is as a traditional reportage photojournalist. And the reasons that I have slipped away from that genre in some instances is usually because of the presence of so many of my colleagues. That was the case in Maidan Square in 2014 during the revolution. And that was also the case covering the Rohingya crisis last September. I wasn't the only journalist who was there. Of course, if I was, it would be my responsibility to represent everything that I saw. But these photographs exist in the context of my colleagues' work. We all know what a line of women wearing shalwar kameezes, carrying plastic bags full of belongings through rice paddies look like. And I'm not sure it serves the story to keep making those photographs. In the same instance in Ukraine, I was just trying to think about what I could add to the collective visual documentation of what was happening there. And since the digital revolution and the advent of social media and the prevalence of so many smartphones and tablets in the places where these historic events are taking place, it doesn't really make sense anymore to behave like the only photojournalist in a specific area whose job it is to represent a whole situation.
Many of your subjects in these photos, Anastasia, have evidence of injuries. They're in bandages. Some of them hide their faces in anguish or show wounds of conflict or torture. Others simply look back at you or into the distance. There's a real array of reactions that you've got from the people you photographed.
The question I ask myself is, what does war look like? What does intent, organized mass violence look like? I mean, it's my job to visualize that. But in portraiture, it's my hope that I may recognize just for a moment the experience on somebody's face that shows what they've been through. In the smallest way, of course, a photograph can never replace experience. My photographs are not as raw and rich and visceral as the experience of sitting there myself as an individual and meeting someone who had experienced this extreme and outrageous trauma so recently. But at the same time, there's a vast chasm between the experience for me of sitting there and meeting someone and having actually experienced it yourself. And that's a challenge for all of us in journalism, to try in some way to bridge these small chasms between lived experience and my own experience of reporting and then showing my photographs or speaking about that to somebody else.
Anastasia Taylor-Lind, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and you might want to be a little more careful when you buy your groceries this week. Rose Acre Farms ordered 200 million eggs off of supermarket shelves. It's one of the largest recalls ever of eggs in this country, and it all came after health officials traced a salmonella outbreak to one of its farms in North Carolina. Ben Chapman joined me to explain this recall. He's a food science professor at North Carolina State University. He's also co-host of the Food Safety Talk podcast.
The recall was announced over the weekend, and it's hard to exactly say how long these eggs have been in production, but I understand that the farm produces somewhere around 20 million eggs per week. So we're probably looking at eggs that have been distributed over the last 10 weeks or so.
20 million eggs per week is just a staggering number. How many people got sick?
To date, there are 22 illnesses. But one of the things that is a little bit interesting about salmonella is that for every illness that we have confirmed, we expect that there's somewhere around 38 other illnesses floating around out there that aren't confirmed. These are people that are sick, but maybe not sick enough to go to the hospital or submit a stool sample to their healthcare provider. So many times with outbreaks like this, it seems like, you know, it's only 22 people, but we can multiply that by about 40.
Well, what happens on the egg farm, on the chicken farm itself, to enable an outbreak like this to get started in the first place? What are the lapses?
It's really, I guess, unclear right now. I think it's early on in the outbreak. In the past, it's really nothing complicated. Salmonella can infect and colonize the chickens themselves, even right into the ovary. So it really could be a situation where the salmonella is in the environment. It's passed from chicken to chicken over time. The chickens don't get sick from this type of salmonella. And then it's deposited in those eggs, and those eggs make it to us as consumers. Usually there's nothing super special about it. It's just the salmonella in the environment making its way into the chickens.
So what can be done at home in the kitchen to reduce the risk here if you're not exactly sure where your eggs came from? Is it just full cooking? Make sure you eat them scrambled? Is it as simple as that?
If the salmonella is on the inside of the egg, cracking that egg open can lead to a chance of cross-contamination, meaning that I drag the salmonella from the inside of the egg to other foods or other spots in my kitchen. That salmonella stays there viable for quite some time. Cooking is definitely a big step to reduce risk. And when it comes to eggs, just cooking those eggs until they set visually will do the majority of work when it comes to risk reduction. And so in this case, there are definitely things that people can do in kitchens to reduce their risk, but I wouldn't just focus solely on cooking.
Well, it sounds like if you have eggs in your fridge from the time of the recall and you're just not sure, you should maybe take the hit and toss them.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with eggs, especially when it comes to cartons, is that there will be, on the package, there will be some sort of a code. It'll have a plant number and a date. And so I would look specifically for the lot codes that are associated with that. And in this outbreak, the plant number is P1065. And there were specific lots. It was lot code 11 through 102. And so if I didn't have eggs that had that information on the package, then I'm going to treat them just like I would have any other time. I want to look, you know, specifically for that area. And one of the things with eggs is they're always a risk for salmonella. And, you know, in this case, it may be a higher risk, but we do expect somewhere in between 1 in 10,000 and 1 in 20,000 eggs to have salmonella in it. So it's a riskier food that we should be handling safely sort of all the time.
Ben Chapman of North Carolina State University and host of the Food Safety Talk podcast. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's get some more on food safety now in an American food supply that relies on mass production. This year is the 25th anniversary of the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak that spread across 73 stores. It sickened 700 people and led to 4 deaths.
We've got to find ways to do more inspections and to try to do them in a more effective way.
President Bill Clinton there responding to the outbreak back in 1993. That incident changed how the USDA and the FDA monitor and regulate food safety today. And it's part of the reason why my next guest says the recent recalls of eggs and packaged romaine lettuce are actually signs of success. Bill Marler is an attorney who specializes in foodborne illness and safety. He's publisher of the online news site Food Safety News.
I was involved in the Jack in the Box outbreak, representing most of the kids that got sick or died. And so I've been sort of in the middle of this for a long time. And really, for the first 4 or 5 years of my law practice, 90% of my work was E. coli cases linked to hamburger. And, you know, today that's near zero. And so that's a real success story. I mean, E. coli cases linked to hamburger are, you know, at record lows. E. coli actually is down as a percentage of foodborne illnesses. We still see, you know, salmonella outbreaks that are occurring. We're importing a lot more food, so that's a challenge. But overall, sort of the nuts and bolts and the guts of food safety regulation is there. It was built up, frankly, during the Clinton and then the Obama administration. And so I guess you could call it the deep state of foodborne illness is there, and it's actually functioning.
Well, what does that deep state look like? I mean, are we talking about legions of USDA inspectors in egg production facilities all over America, or are producers more serious about the potential marketing cost of outbreaks and so that they're just being cleaner and better?
Yeah, it's really a combination of the technology that exists today for catching outbreaks. When I first started doing this, we were using, you know, very simplistic genetic fingerprinting. We're now using whole genome sequencing. So we're looking at, you know, 3 million bands of the DNA. And that's being able to tell people pretty quickly that, you know, this person, and this food product are connected, and boom, you pull the product off the market. So technology has really advanced the surveillance of foodborne illness, but it does require people. It requires people in public health labs. It requires epidemiologists, you know, on the surveillance side. But to answer your real specific question about what's going on inside food production facilities, the regulations both at USDA and FDA have put more responsibility onto those producers to produce food, not necessarily in the fox guarding the hen house kind of way, but there is oversight. Would I like to see more oversight? Sure. But in the context of real budgets and that kind of pressure, the people at FDA and USDA are doing a remarkable job, and people are less sick. You know, frankly, today we're catching outbreaks faster, but there's still problems. And, you know, this week, you know, with lettuce and eggs, it's there.
Bill Marler, if there's been one thing that has really defined the Trump administration so far, it's been deregulation. In industry after industry, the Trump administration has moved to loosen or undo rules where they can. Has that affected food safety? Do you see the Trump administration at the USDA or the FDA trying to loosen some of these rules?
You know, I hesitate to say the truth, which is they haven't done it. And I'd say that because I don't want to encourage them to do it. The system's working. You know, it's not perfect. We're always going to have some outbreaks, but they're smaller and we're catching them quicker. So, you know, I know that the president, you know, likes his safe food, and I would continue to urge them to, you know, leave well enough alone. It's working. It's not broken. There's no reason to try to fix it.
Bill Marler, attorney and publisher of the online news site Food Safety News. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.